progress.
Thank you. It's been a minute. I would like to call to order the Planning Commission regular meeting of Thursday, July 3rd, 2025. Carla, will you call roll, please?
Chair Brinson.
Here.
Commissioner Cabe.
Here.
Commissioner Hadley.
Present.
Commissioner Lynn.
Here.
Vice Chair Mosier.
Here.
Commissioner Povich.
Here.
Thank you. Commissioner Fry is absent with notice. Thank you.
Excellent. Approval of the agenda. All right, we're good to go. Approval of the last meeting's minutes. Any comments? Nope, we're good there too. Carla, do we have anybody signed up for public comments?
We have no one signed up tonight. Thank you.
All right, turning it over to you for our environmentally critical areas code update discussion.
Good evening, commissioners. Thank you for being here on the eve of a holiday. Really appreciate it. Here to discuss our critical areas code updates. Shoreline is in the process of updating its critical areas code by the end of 2025 to be consistent with the Growth Management Act. When we did an evaluation of the existing code, we found that the area that was in need of revisions was related to streams, and so that's what we are focusing the majority of the update effort on. So to that end, this evening we'll be spending time learning about the Department of Fish and Wildlife's science synthesis and management recommendations for riparian ecosystems, and I'll get into what all of that means. And then going to tee up a discussion, because there are some items that staff would really appreciate some direction from Planning Commission on, so we know where to put our efforts. And then a brief preview of next steps. So first, let's talk about streams and how they are currently regulated. Streams are regulated based on the type of stream that we're talking about. Typically, that's whether or not it involves fish, or if it is a stream year-round, or maybe it dries up during the dry season. These streams themselves are considered critical areas, and the lands around them are buffers. And those buffers vary in width, largely based on the presence or absence of fish. So that's currently what's happening in Shoreline. What that looks like is this map here. So what we have is, it's a little hard to see when we're zoomed out to see the whole city, but these are buffers of various widths based on the different types of streams that occur in the city. And what we are now looking at are the publications from the Department of Fish and Wildlife related to riparian ecosystems. These are the lands around the streams. WDFW has two volumes that they have published. One, the science synthesis, and the second is the management recommendations. Most of our time this evening is going to be spent on the science. We'll just touch briefly on the management. We'll come back at later meetings to talk about that in more depth. So, what is a riparian ecosystem? This is the transitional area between terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. It's those upland areas near a stream that influence a stream's health. And per WDFW's guidance, these riparian ecosystems should be treated as critical areas themselves, not as buffers. So previously, that land next to the stream, that was a buffer. WDFW's guidance is to treat that as a critical area called a riparian ecosystem. And these riparian ecosystems perform five key ecosystem functions. And those include, first, bank stability. So the stability of a stream bank is influenced by the soil, groundwater, and vegetation. When a stream bank is stable, that's really important for stream health, as excessive erosion can really damage habitat and lower water quality, and also prove to be a hazard for property, people in property nearby that stream bank. So a well-vegetated riparian area, those roots help to grab onto the soil and make sure that the stream bank does not erode away down the river. The next critical riparian ecosystem function is stream shading. So this is vegetation nearby a stream, and it's all about cooling down the water temperature. So cool water is really preferred for most aquatic species in the Northwest. That's just what they have evolved to thrive in. And the temperature of water can really impact the survivability and productivity of aquatic species. So if the water is too hot, that really drops off. So a well-vegetated riparian ecosystem helps by providing shade. Next is wood recruitment. And wood plays a really important role in the width, depth, velocity, and size of streams. Wood that falls into a stream, maybe it's a tree branch or maybe an entire tree itself, that really introduces diversity and complexity into the habitat and kind of creates these little micro ecosystems within the stream where different species can find their niche and really thrive. Next is litter fall. So this is smaller biomass. Maybe we're talking about moss, leaves, twigs, those kinds of things that fall into the stream, and then they start to decompose. They're being eaten up by microbes, detritivores, by invertebrates, and that's a really important baseline for the food chain because that's what the fish rely on in order to meet their nutritional needs. And the fifth and final riparian ecosystem function is the removal of pollutants. So when it rains and water either percolates into the ground or it flows over the surface, a well-vegetated riparian ecosystem can trap and slow down any excess nutrients, metals, pesticides, oils, all kinds of stuff from getting into the stream and impacting the water quality. So those are the five different riparian ecosystem functions. So we've learned what a riparian ecosystem is, five different riparian ecosystem functions. Now, how do you identify a riparian ecosystem? What does that mean on the Earth? What does that mean spatially? So WDFW has prepared some science synthesis that discusses how to identify a riparian ecosystem. And so I want us to all look at this image and try to keep it in our brains as we go to the next slide. WDFW recommends that the zone of influence be identified, and that's based on those five ecosystem functions that we were just talking about. And how you would measure the riparian ecosystem is from the edge of the stream channel at the ordinary high water mark out to the end of the zone of influence. And in order to determine what that length is between the edge of the stream and the zone of influence, it's using something called the Forest Ecosystem Management Assessment Team Curve, or FEMAT curve. What is a FEMAT curve? A FEMAT curve is a conceptual model of riparian ecosystem functions. It contemplates four out of the five that were listed. The one it's missing is pollutant removal. And what it looks at is the vegetation's role, specifically old growth trees' role in stream health. So it's assuming that it's based on the height of a dominant tree, and any space between that tree and the stream itself is performing one of those four out of those five riparian ecosystem functions. And essentially what the FEMAT curve shows is that the ecosystem functions are greatest within that one unit of dominant tree height. So if you get farther away from the stream, you're not performing as many ecosystem functions as if you're closer to the stream. That's ultimately what it is saying. Viewed another way, which I found a little more approachable, was if you take the average maximum height of the tallest dominant tree, that's a tree that's 200 years old or more, and next to the stream and just laid it on its side, what would that distance be? That is the site potential tree height, and that is the zone of influence. That is the riparian ecosystem. So all of those different terms mean the same thing in terms of linear feet when you're measuring the distance from the stream. Why 200 years, you might ask? That is the minimum age for a tree to be considered old growth. So if you're 50, you're a spring chicken in terms of tree years. And the FEMOT curve really assumes that in order to have full riparian ecosystem functions, you're in an old growth forest scenario. So that's the sort of baked in assumption of full riparian ecosystem functions occur in old growth forest scenarios. So to summarize, how wide is a riparian ecosystem? Well, you measure from the edge of the stream to the outer edge of that zone of influence using the site potential tree height. That's that dominant tree laid on its side. That's going to be the width of the riparian ecosystem. So how do we figure out what a site potential tree height is for shoreline? What does that mean? Well, the Department of Fish and Wildlife has prepared an online tool that's for the entire state of Washington. It utilizes soils data that tell us what types of trees grow where and how tall they are likely to become, and using that to determine site potential tree height. Unfortunately, shoreline is one of the few jurisdictions where WDFW did not have the soil data necessary in order to determine the site potential tree height. So what DFW did is they estimated based on the soils data around shoreline. So anything within a 2-mile buffer, what were those tree heights for those dominant tree species? They averaged those and provided us with an estimated average maximum height of a dominant tree. Now in shoreline, that is a either a red alder at 103 feet or it is a Douglas fir at 202 feet. WDFW's recommendation when there are multiple potentially dominant tree species is to use the larger one. So what does that look like in terms of regulations for critical areas? Here's a comparison of the stream types and how currently they are regulated based on buffers, which are of variable widths, dependent on whether or not fish are present, into this model that WDFW is recommending related to riparian ecosystems based on site potential tree height, which would be 202 feet across the board. And that's what this looks like on the map. Again, when it's all zoomed out, it's a little hard to tell, but what you've got is a 200 feet out in either direction of a stream, and it does not matter whether or not that stream contains fish. The riparian ecosystem is 202 feet. Now, under the current critical areas code, approximately 1,400 properties are impacted by critical areas and buffers. That means they likely have limitations on development. And under this model of riparian ecosystems that are now 202 feet, the estimated number of properties are impacted are 1,978. So we've got an increase in the number of properties that are going to be impacted by critical areas. And so under the current model, some properties are not impacted by critical areas, but moving forward with the riparian management zone model, they would be impacted by critical areas. So in summary of the guidance, previously, streams were considered critical areas. They had buffers around them. Those buffers varied in width based on whether or not fish were present. New guidance from WDFW says streams are still critical areas. That did not change. The lands around them are riparian ecosystems, also to be considered critical areas. And that size of the riparian ecosystem, it's not about whether or not fish are in the stream. It's about the site potential tree height. And in shoreline, that site potential tree height is estimated to be 202 feet. So I wanted to pause here with, because I've just thrown a bunch of science at you, and just sort of check for clarity if there were any questions on the science synthesis from WDFW. I've got the other discussion questions later, but this is sort of a check-in on riparian ecosystems. What are they? What are their ecosystem functions? Site potential tree height. Any questions on that? Okay. That's really exciting to hear. So now I'm teeing up for, I think, a more of a discussion topic where staff are really looking for some guidance from Planning Commission, again, to figure out where we should put our efforts. So in these publications, WDFW was really clear that they had specific goals, assumptions, and caveats. First is that as an agency, WDFW's goal is to protect and restore fully functioning riparian areas. That is their main concern. Baked into the model that they recommend, the FEMOT curve, is this assumption that an old growth forest is what is needed in order to have fully functioning riparian areas. Therefore, what WDFW's science-backed recommendation for using site potential tree height, it is contemplating a desired future condition of an old growth forest, because that is what will have fully functioning riparian ecosystems. WDFW also makes it clear that they are only considering ecological impacts. They are not considering social or economic impacts. Ultimately, that is the goal of local governments to talk about in forums like this through a public process of how we balance these different goals. And then WDFW was also very clear that there are limitations in the data, and what they have for site potential tree height for jurisdictions like shoreline is an estimate. So that's one frame of the discussion. The next is the Growth Management Act itself. The Growth Management Act has, I believe now, 15 different goals, and I pulled together a sample of some of these that are relevant to the topic of critical areas. So the Growth Management Act seeks to protect and enhance the environment, to be resilient to climate change, to enhance open space and recreation opportunities for the public, to concentrate urban growth in areas that are already developed and reduce sprawl, to increase housing in those urban areas, and to protect property rights. The Growth Management Act is very clear that with these 15 goals, it's not a ranked order of them. It is, again, the responsibility of local governments to look at these different goals and talk about balancing them when they are preparing for different goals, or excuse me, when they are preparing for different policies and regulations. The next sort of pillar of this frame is the Growth Management Act does require communities to have critical areas protections in place, and there are some specific parameters around those. So critical areas codes need to protect the critical areas' functions and values. Importantly, the Growth Management Act does not require fully functioning critical areas. It's just current conditions, which in some cases are impacted or degraded. So it's sort of this no net loss concept of you cannot go below what are present functions and values, not necessarily a desired future condition, not necessarily fully functioning. The Growth Management Act requires cities to use best available science when preparing their critical areas codes, so you can't just make something up or ignore the science, and of course that you have to have special consideration for the protection of salmon, which are so important to Washington State. And sort of the last frame for this discussion, I just wanted to touch base on what is best available science. That is science that is presently available and practically and economically feasible to obtain. We understand that there are gaps in scientific knowledge and there are limits on things that can be known, that's why it is best available science. So it's science that's gleaned through a valid scientific process, relevant to the critical area, and prepared by qualified professionals. All right, so we're almost at the question. What staff are grappling with is understanding the options for determining riparian ecosystem size. What we see is two options: to follow the recommendations from WDFW or potentially depart from those recommendations. We are aware of other urban jurisdictions within the central Puget Sound that are looking at potentially departing from WDFW's recommendations because they are seeking to balance these 15 different goals of the Growth Management Act, whereas WDFW has a very clear mandate of what their goal is for fully functioning riparian ecosystems. WDFW is very clear that their best available science of using site potential tree height is appropriate and scientifically backed if the goal is to have fully functioning riparian ecosystems. So there is a goal associated with that science-backed recommendation. What I do want to be clear is that really either option, what we're seeing from other jurisdictions who are grappling with this right now, so it's an evolving state, as we do anticipate that it will increase the number of properties that are impacted by critical areas either way that we go. What we're seeing from some other jurisdictions who are looking at other options, they're getting to riparian ecosystems of maybe about 150 feet. So in terms of the difference between what the estimated site potential tree height is for shoreline at 202, 150 is what others are sort of coming to. So I just wanted to put that out there to help frame the discussion, because here's the question that staff have. We're trying to understand if a commission wants staff to explore potentially departing from WDFW's recommendations about determining riparian ecosystem width. We anticipate that would be bringing on a consultant to help us understand what would be an appropriate science-based approach. Or, again, looking at all the growth management goals and policies, is the recommendation from WDFW appropriate for shoreline, and should we just proceed with that? That's the question.
Hi, thank you for presenting on the eve of a holiday. Would it be possible to go back to the map, the new map?
Just to
orient, I want to make sure I'm saying it correctly. Thank you. Got it. I mean, it's hard to, I get a little confused because sometimes the only road labeled is Aurora, so I have to imagine where I am in the city. I mean, my takeaway, at least looking at the west side of the city, is like it some of it, like the 202 versus going to 150, it seems somewhat immaterial to me, as a lot of the neighborhoods affected by that are Innis Arden and Highlands, which in and of themselves are covenant controlled things that are already going to have limited development. So even if we increased the properties affected by it, there's already so many constraints on property development, at least in that part of town, that it's not a huge, truly a huge impact. I don't admittedly know what's going on in that upper right hand corner. I can't picture where North City ends right in that in relation to the streams. I know there's a hill, so I think it's all kind of downhill from that in the residential area, which is a slope because you're going down a hill. Yeah, like right in there.
Sort of in here. Does the mouse show up? This area, it's only showing the streams, but it does also have a number of wetlands there as well, so it really lights up. But it is, yes, down a slope, down a slope and wet.
I think for me, that I think just at first blush, and I'm willing to change my opinion of other things, I think I would be okay just sticking with the 202 just because it's a simple number to do it, unless there's another city that's doing a compelling thing. I had written down 150 just because if you divide the two trees, that's what you get as well.
Which maybe is how they landed at 150, yeah. Right?
Just a quick question that I'm just wondering if we say, assuming the all that area, assuming that we follow the 202, and then go for the no net loss, because what's already there, it will maybe stand for another 100 or 200 years, we don't know. So calculate all other areas at maximum growth, especially for like overlaying the MUR zones. That's our high concentrate growth area, to see if there are any of that zone or those high density area being affected by this. That will be the bigger impact or the, in terms of limitation to cities' growing target. And say if we want to deviate from the 202, maybe we only consider those area, yeah, because we are already designating those area as high growth area.
If helpful, we did prepare a map with zoning. I didn't include it in the presentation because I wasn't sure if we were going to get that far, but here it is. And there are a few properties that are impacted by the larger buffers, but it's mostly areas that were already zoned commercial, and so based on our zoning sort of methodology, the zone didn't change. Mm-hmm. We were really intentional when we were rezoning from R6 and R4 into the NR zones that we tried to identify the open channel streams and keep those areas around there the lower density zone. So we thought about that. And good. I think largely it has aligned fairly well. It's areas where there were already they were already zoned for commercial uses that they it just didn't change because they were impacted before. And now they're still impacted, but the size is larger. But there are areas that, like in the Richmond Beach Shopping Center example, that are already paved, right? It's built. So we do expect some is going to be impacted in our more dense zones, like commercial specifically mm-hmm. zones. Not so much in the light rail station areas, though. But I can provide that map the next time to sort of talk through it, but I think it matches up fairly well.
And then a following question is, so I see there are the piped areas. Yes. So will there be, so that also means it, like for the future when we are doing the growth calculation, do we consider any area that we are going to pipe more streams? If not, that's no change. And what I'm trying to get at is in terms of the properties that with stream going through, it seems quite unfair. Right, there are the piped area, there is no requirement at all, and they are actually degrading the stream a whole lot. And then it's those that are daylighted, I mean the remaining that's needing to like trying to return the stream health. So I don't know how to justify that, but it's just wondering, looking at that entire, let's say the Boeing Creek, a large portion that's east of Aurora, that's entirely capped. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I hear what you're saying about the unfairness, right? A change in regulation. You know, one day you're not on a property that has any encumbrances, and then the next day you are, and that's really challenging. I think that's at the next time I come before you to sort of talk through how to deal with that. So that properties are, they're suddenly non-conforming because the rules changed, but what's considered reasonable for them, what expansions are appropriate, where could that happen on properties, so that you are still protecting critical areas but allowing people use of their properties. Mm-hmm. So I will have more questions and requests for policy guidance around that specifically.
I think that's the piece for me. I'm not, critical areas is the probably the least familiar for me in the code. And it feels like I don't know enough to understand what this means. Like I understand the science that you just presented. That was very, very clear. But when we lay that on to, okay, here's a map with all of these properties, and we're talking about more than doubling the amount of land that's associated with critical area code, I don't know what that means. So it would be really helpful to discuss that. What does our critical area code restrict folks from doing or not doing, and how do we deal with it? Okay. That's one piece, because I think if we're discussing this, you know, sort of publicly, and we're talking about an impact to folks' properties one day versus another, I think it's an important conversation to have. Yeah. And an important consideration, since, I mean, if I'm back of the envelope mapping, it feels like many of these parcels are in our neighborhood residential zones, where we just spent a lot of time talking about adding housing density, and that is a balancing act with this. So I think I would like, so I'm not, I'm leaning more towards understanding more so we can maybe make sure that we're doing the best balancing act versus just adopting WDFW.
Understood.
Yeah, I've got a question about, do we know if, has there been any discussions or if there's plans for daylighting any of these pipes? Because that would definitely expand, you know, what we'd be looking at as far as riparian management zones and that sort of thing. Do you know of anything that's been discussed within the city?
Not that I'm personally aware of, but I am working with our surface water team, because they deal with a lot of these pipes, to understand how the critical areas code will impact that. So I can check and see if they've got anything. I don't know if on the immediate horizon, but maybe something further out where they're thinking about it. Because yes, that would make a difference.
Yeah, thank you. But also getting, I guess, more towards your question, kind of considering that there haven't really been studies WDFW, I would lean towards trying to get a consultant and kind of getting more, you know, what's actually going on within the city, than rather than making assumptions based on what's around the city. Yeah.
Because you mentioned there is no soil data for City of Shoreline, so who has that data, or just basically none?
I think based on whatever data set WDFW used, because they had to do something that worked for most of the state, that whatever that data set didn't include Shoreline and a couple of other jurisdictions. There may be other data sets more at the local level that we could essentially
look into
as our own calculations. That's my assumption, because there's a lot of soil data out there, so I was a little surprised that they didn't have any, but we can, you know, investigate that further.
Thanks.
I have a question. Do you think that there's lack of data because we were Seattle for so long, that our data was kind of incorporated into there, and maybe you can extrapolate areas of Seattle and see if it was just kind of misnamed instead of not here?
Potentially. I can reach out to WDFW. They've been a really supportive partner in this to sort of help me understand what all of the science was, to sort of ask those questions about more about the data, what's going on there, why, because it's Seattle and Shoreline. It's also Spokane and Bellingham and Tacoma.
Okay.
So there's a number of jurisdictions out there.
I just think about all the confusion that happens often because we became Shoreline not that recent past. I too agree that we should have a consultant. I think that when you're starting to, you know, do things with people's property, you need to have really good data and really good experts that tell you everyone that you are right in your thought process.
And importantly, WDFW, they encourage that the site potential tree height be established on like a site basis, that someone can really, you know, sample the soil on the property in question and determine the site potential tree height utilizing their methodology. I anticipate that is expensive for a property owner. That's something that then they need to turn it into the city, that we need to check that they did the work correctly. So while I understand getting, you know, as precise of data as possible, that is the ideal scenario. I do also want to be sensitive to the thought that there's a cost to that for applicants. So it's tricky.
Yeah, I agree. I just kind of think about, you know, the conversation that would go back and forth about, you know, surrounding areas are doing 150 and we're coming in at 200. And why, you know, why is that? How did you get to that number? And, you know, to have some kind of data or some kind of something to put behind the numbers, mm-hmm. unless we wanted to go with 150 to just be across the board. But I think that whenever you deviate from what is going around you, you just have to have really good reasons mm-hmm. that people will agree with.
I think you've just hit on why we had state-mandated housing policy. but that's a different story. I think when we look at this, brought a good point about zoning map. I think it'd be interesting, you brought up the wetlands, to see these in the context of the other critical areas, because mm-hmm. there's a number of them that are on steep slopes. Mm-hmm. So by changing things, we also may not be further encumbering their property, because it's not only a stream, it's also on a hill like this. So just to submit, because it seems like the increase in properties was something, but it might not actually be a huge change.
Right, like where is, I guess your question is really sort of, when you add everything together, which properties are being added?
Absolutely.
And I think the interesting thing too about the unfairness of it is this entire city could not be built even under our current rules. Like almost all of it was timber holdings that was clear cut. And like we would never pipe a stream like that today. Like there's a giant one running down Third Avenue that probably would not occur today. So laws change over time. So it may not be fair, but we also have a zone to zone difference in what you can build anyway. So you could also perceive that as an unfairness. So I think I'd like to be careful about, for me at least, how we talk about fairness, because we do prejudice things in other ways for other reasons as we talk about development.
Yeah. I wasn't really thinking about fairness. I was thinking about how the conversation would go and what you would say.
Well, yeah, somebody... sorry, I talked about fairness of like piped versus unpiped streams. So I think it's a historical development thing, just to be careful with the word. But
yeah.
One other thing that popped into my head as Bradley was talking was, I think Fish and Wildlife has been talking a lot about fish passage and changing of piped streams. So it might be good to talk to the surface water folks about whether they expect that to push some change. Mm-hmm. I know that's happening to the south a little bit. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Misha?
I'm just wondering, in our comp plan, did we have a if we look at the comp plan in terms of the environmental, those policies, so are there, maybe we pull out a certain language that's more related to you know, the growth versus the eco health, ecosystem health. And just wanting to overlay that to see if our comp plan has emphasis on, like, any emphasis heavier on either side. just curious. That is one thought to look at. And then another thinking is, I also see there are, in urban areas, there are efforts to, from the city, purchasing properties that are, you know, has more potential of flooding and less possibility for good development. And if the, for those area, if we already have that in our database, let's say even if there is no this 202 feet increase, those area are constricted initially, I mean, already. So I'm just thinking, is it worthwhile that we also kind of using this overlap to identify those potential, the property that are already potential kind of in risk. And those may be good location for future open space development. I don't know what that impact to the growth management, but that should have been, you know, taking out from the maximum growth possibility anyway. So maybe that help us recalibrate our growth management. I don't know. Yeah, just, yeah.
Anyone else? Oh, go ahead.
I know I've been quiet because you all have had such great questions, but I agree with you about coming back with more information so we can make a more educated advice or feedback for the staff.
So. Sorry, Elise, you have more work to do.
That's okay. That was question three, is what additional information? And I think I've got a good list from like policy guidance, from the comprehensive plan to the critical areas code itself, what's an allowed use and alteration, what are we talking about in terms of impact with other critical areas, how they're mapped, are these properties already encumbered, and how that looks for zoning. So did I miss anything?
Good. That was my list. All right.
Terrific. Thank you.
Excellent.
So just a preview of the schedule. This summer, we'll be talking about critical areas. And then in the fall, aiming for a hearing on the actual draft code. So.
And that fish will move. Excellent. All right. Is that the conclusion of our study items? Okay. Do we have any unfinished business? Seeing none. New business? Nope. Reports and announcements? Still no agenda for our next meeting.
For our next meeting, there will be a public hearing about parking minimums and bike parking. So that'll be a big policy decision. And then I'll be back to talk about critical areas with some very cool maps.
Excellent. And I'm just looking at the calendar because we also have our next gathering on July 14th. At what time?
I believe that I believe it's at 5:45, but the food is there at 5:30, so you could come early to get food again up at room 303 on the third floor.
Excellent.
Talking about trees with the city council.
All trees, all the time. Excellent. So we will see you again on July 14th and then again on July 17th.
Yes.
Perfect. With that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.